What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we can get that question answered on today's program. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177, wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Those of you watching on TV, you can participate as well. Here's our email address for you folks, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles is our producer. Vanessa Sanchez is handling a phone screening. Rich Jesse on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. So just put your question in the comments box if you would. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us in Radio Studio One and we'll get your question answered. Again, the phone number 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Well, I thought I was doing well until the throat started acting up.
Well, sorry, man.
You know what we say in our family, right?
I don't know.
Our bodies keep us humble.
They do that indeed.
They do indeed. All right. We're going to lead off with an email from Shane now. I heard there is an old and a new theology on St. Paul. Can you comment on this?
Yes, absolutely. I really appreciate the question. You've actually keyed in on something I have an interest in, right?
Really?
So the first, say, 300 years of interpretation of St. Paul in the early church looks very different from the way the interpretation of Paul looks after the 4th century.
Okay.
And to take one point of emphasis, when Paul wrote in Romans and Galatians about the law and Gentiles and faith and grace, the first several centuries of Christians assumed that he was talking about what he said he was talking about, namely the relationship of Jews and Gentiles and their respective relationships to the law of Moses. And so once you had a largely Gentile church, that aspect of Paul's writing seemed less relevant to the church fathers. And so they would emphasize, early church fathers emphasized other areas of Paul's thought, particularly his doctrine mm-hmm. of union with Christ and having the mind of Christ and mm-hmm. illumination by the Spirit and his ethical thinking. And these kinds of things predominated in Pauline interpretation. Then in the 4th century, particularly in the Latin West, especially in the works of St. Augustine, some of his predecessors like Cyprian, but especially in Augustine, the Pauline concept of justification and faith and grace and the law took on a different connotation. And in Augustine's commentary, those concepts become more expansive than just focused on the Jew-Gentile question and become a kind of frame of reference for interpreting all of Pauline soteriology. Soteriology mm-hmm. means the doctrine of salvation.
Okay.
And then in the Latin West, and you know, developed through the scholastic tradition, that became sort of the dominant way of entry into St. Paul. It was, you know, Paul's writing on mm-hmm. justification, faith, grace, and predestination became the sort of the lens for understanding his whole manner of thought. But abstracted a little bit from that early church context of Jew-Gentile relationships. In the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther really zeroed in on the soteriological interpretation of Paul's letter to Romans and Galatians and almost completely divorced it from the early Jewish context. And in fact, so much so that he took Paul's writings about the law to refer not to the law of Moses as such, but to morality in general, and hence, you know, Luther's concept of justification by faith alone, apart from works of the law, means in Luther, salvation apart from moral striving. So we've really come a very long way from the frame of reference that the early church had when they read Paul on these issues. The Council of Trent, of course, rejected Luther's doctrine of justification, but it did not reject the soteriological angle that that Western Christianity had brought to bear on the interpretation of those letters. And so for the next, 500 years or so, debates in Pauline scholarship, still are framed within that paradigm, okay? Who's right? Is it the Council of Trent, or is it the Lutheran tradition that understands justification correctly? Then there was a revolution in Pauline studies that took place in the mid-20th century called the New Perspectives on Paul movement. And it was really animated by a rediscovery of Jewish literature, pre-Christian and contemporary, with the first century Christian literature of Second Temple Judaism, particularly in the works of a fellow by the name of E.P. Sanders. And Sanders's contention and others that followed after him were that the Catholics and the Protestants were bringing the wrong frame of reference to studying Paul, and that the first three centuries of the Christian church were more on point, right? That the Jew-Gentile question is really paramount in Paul and frames the way we should understand these other doctrines. And that transformation became known as the New Perspectives on Paul movement. Now, the shakeout from that, the fallout from that, is that lots of guys like me became Catholic, right? Because and most of these scholars are Protestants. Uh-huh. And for me, it was a revelation when I began to read E.P. Sanders and James Dunn and Christer Stendahl and N.T. Wright, others that now Jewish New Testament scholars I'll give you the names in a minute. My mind's just gone blank, but I've got several in mind, have gotten in on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And, the revelation for me as a Protestant scholar was how badly Luther had misframed and misunderstood the Pauline tradition. And while, the New Perspectives folks would take issue with some Catholic exegesis as well, they put such a heavy emphasis on the element of corporate identity, what constitutes you as a member of the people of God, that mm-hmm. there was an unmissable, unmistakable ecclesiological dimension to reading Paul. As he transcends the Jew-Gentile distinction, that in my way of thinking aligned much more closely with the way Catholics understand our identity in Christ as being an ecclesial reality in the heart of the church that he founded, and the moral transformation of the human person in that context was much more amenable to a Catholic reading. And so a lot of people have read that stuff and ended up becoming Catholic in consequence.
Well, there you go. Shane, thanks so much for your email today. In a moment, we're going to talk with Mackenzie in Pasco, Washington. We have some lines open for you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're watching us on TV today, you can shoot us an email, ctc@EWTN.com. We're going to get to Mackenzie on the phone in just a second here. Have you checked out Church Pop? It is wonderful. Church Pop takes a fresh and fun look at the news shaping our world, featuring engaging, inspiring, and informative Catholic social media content. You can find it on Snapchat, on Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com. You can also get Church Pop content directly into your email inbox. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Mackenzie, a first-time caller from Pasco, Washington, listening on the great KHSS, Catholic Radio. Mackenzie, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Anders.
Howdy.
I am a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the way I see it, I am the one that's based in Salt Lake City, not the FLDS, and in knowing that, I would believe to some extent, like the Catholic Church, being as the one based on Salt Lake City has a massive following and all that, we in some way or another have a bit of a Catholic in that terminology, universal aspect to us. But what I would like to know is, knowing that you guys, through the Vicar of Christ, have a connection to God, would we, through our prophet Russell M. Nelson, have a connection to God?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So if I might, I'd like to kind of back up and reframe the way Catholics understand themselves, because a Catholic would not, it would not come naturally to the mouth of a Catholic to say, I have a connection to God through the Pope. That's not, we wouldn't start there, right? Let me back up and explain how Catholics see reality. So we think that we are connected to God through the created order, because in him we live and move and have our being, as St. Paul says in Acts chapter 17. And we're made in his likeness and image. And so there's something of the divine that's sort of imprinted on our nature. Problem is that we don't access it very well. And in fact, we have these habits of sin that cling to us, pride and concupiscence and greed and lust and all these other kind of things. And so in order to really let the image of God within us shine, those things need to be reformed. They need to be polished up. And that takes place supernaturally through the gift of grace, which ultimately is what Christ came to bring. And the cleaner that picture becomes, the more we get that stuff sort of fixed up, the closer and closer our connection to God. And the whole process leads ultimately to a concept that is familiar to LDS, although we would mean something very different by it, and that's the process of theosis, or divinization. By that, we do not mean getting our own planet when we die, but rather coming to reflect God's nature more and more in our character, in our way of looking at reality, and ultimately in the love that is exhibited in our lives. And so it's a process over the course of time. Now when we talk about how do we get that grace that transforms us more and more into the likeness and image of God, or I should say restores within us that likeness and image of God, well, God gave us means. He gave us instruments to help facilitate that process. They're not exclusively within the church, but privileged in the church. So, I mean, the created order itself bears witness to the divine majesty and glory and to our need for redemption and to the moral order. All those things can be accessible through reason. But the teaching and example of Christ is obviously a major advance. I mean, go to the book of Hebrews, it's sort of the definitive revelation of God. And so obeying the teaching of Christ, following his example, seeking to incorporate, to assimilate his divine personality, come to see the world through Christ's eyes. That's sort of the major engine of growth in the Christian life. And then those truths are imprinted on our personality in a nonverbal way through the sacraments of the church, baptism and the Eucharist and confirmation and confession, holy orders, ordination, divine unction, these kinds of things are these special tools that God has given us as Christians to rework the image of God within us. And we believe those are sort of supernaturally effective. In conveying this teaching to the people of God, we believe that Christ sent representatives, delegates that were commissioned by him with authority to teach with authority. And that would be not just the Pope, but it's the whole order of bishops, right? Christ had 12 disciples, one wigged out, and we got a replacement, got 2.0 in there. But those 12 apostles have successors that continue to exist down into the church today in the form of the Catholic bishops. And so my connection to God it's not uniquely through my bishop or even the Pope. Those people have offices in a church that oversees a sacramental apparatus and teaching, the whole purpose of which is to unite me to God. And so, there are like lots of avenues of union with God that Catholics lay hold of, right? And we're not sort of uniquely constrained within the personality of the priest or the Pope or the bishop. Mm-hmm. Those people have a very important function in the church, but I wouldn't say that my relationship with God is sort of uniquely funneled through the person of the Pope, if you see what I'm saying. So I just want to, like, one could misconstrue that language, and I wanted to give you a real sense of the way Catholics see their connection to God and the role that the Pope has. And the Pope is a human being who sometimes is infallible, but oftentimes, he can just be a human being. And so he has an office and he has authority, but he's not, we don't see him in the same light that you would see the Mormon prophet, who, if I'm not mistaken, I think you can correct me about this, that the Mormon prophet can allege to give out a fundamentally new revelation and sort of, change mid-course and make a 180 on something if he says that this is what God told him. And that's typically not the way the Pope behaves. Now, to the question, do I think that Mormons have a relationship to God or a connection to God, whether through their prophet or some other way? Mm-hmm. Catholic Church sees itself this way, says that the Catholic Church is the institution created by God and sent by Christ that has this job of teaching the truth and sanctifying people. But like I mentioned, there's not just one element of the Catholic faith that unites us to God. There are many. And so it's possible to look around the world and say, well, here are some other people that have, well, maybe they don't have everything that we've got, but they've got elements of truth and sanctification. Maybe they don't have all our sacraments. Maybe they don't have apostolic succession. Maybe they don't have the Pope or the Bishop or the priests. But, you know, let's say maybe they got at least some of the Bible. Maybe they have the New Testament. Well, New Testament's good stuff, right? You know, it teaches the truth of Christ, right?
Sure, sure.
That's a means of sanctification and redemption. It's not the whole package, but it's a good part of it. They are also people made in the likeness and image of God who have their moral sense and intuition and the power of reason, and they can think about the moral life and, you know, the rights and duties of human life together. And those could also be elements of truth and sanctification. And so, you know, I would look at the LDS and I would say, I would ask the question, what are the elements of truth and sanctification that exists within the LDS? Could those be for someone within the LDS a means of sanctification and redemption? And the Catholic Church tells me yes. To the extent that the LDS possesses elements of truth and sanctification, elements that they would share in common with Catholics, to that extent they have access to means that could be salvific for them. Now, I wouldn't, this is, please forgive me, I'm just going to be frank here, I wouldn't necessarily think that that came through the person of your prophet, right? Because, of course, as a Catholic, I don't actually believe his claim to prophecy. And so if your prophet said, for example, you know, don't murder your neighbor, I go, all right, I'm down with that. Let's go, prophet. You know, don't murder your neighbor. Okay, good deal. I'm with you 100%. If he were to say, God has changed his mind and we're going back on the polygamy statute, and we're going to reinstitute polygamy. I mean, they had polygamy once, they got rid of it, now we're going to bring it back. At that point, I'd go, oh, well, I'm not following you there, dude. Not going to that one, you know. Again, not because of, I just don't believe his claim to authority, you see. So it would just be, he would have human authority, and I would agree with it or not, insofar as my reason and the Catholic faith concurred with whatever he said. But your connection to God is ultimately grounded in the created order, in that you are a child of God, created in his likeness and image, and in those truths of sanctification and redemption that you would share in common, first of all, with the patrimony of the human race, and also with the Catholic faith.
Mackenzie, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, and I do respect of what you have said regarding our prophet. I do respect that with the utmost respect.
Well, I appreciate that.
We do thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion here on EWTN with Dr. David Anders. Here's an email from Marla. This is fascinating. Can the normalizing of cremation be a symptom of a society that doesn't want to face death? And does the church still prefer a regular burial?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I have never studied the question sociologically, right, as to why the normalization of cremation within the culture, right? And is it because the culture as a whole does not want to face death? Yeah, I mean, I think that's an empirical question, and I think we could empirically investigate. It's a theory. It's not the one that intuitively jumps to mind.
I'd never thought of it.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, if you know, in my own life, my own family life, I mean, I've had these conversations with my loved ones, and I have had family members that have said to me, for example, I would like to be cremated because I would like to be interred in the church's columbarium. Like, for no other reason, just that, like, we don't have, like, an explicitly Catholic cemetery in my diocese, set aside by the church, consecrated ground, and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the columbarium is just, like, it's so close to the church. It's, like, on church property, and it's so easy to remember your loved ones and to remember them at Mass. And I've had people say, I want to be cremated because the church has made the columbarium available to me, and for no other reason. And if the columbarium were, like, you know, say, I don't know, at the back of the Bama football stadium in Tuscaloosa, you know, I could think of a lot of people that might want to be interred there, but it wouldn't be me, you know, for that a different reason, right?
Sure.
I think there are other people in the culture that are not Catholic who have gotten interested in cremation for basically superstitious reasons, right? I mean, a lot of times you'll hear folks say, well, you know, my loved one wanted to have his ashes, you know, scattered over the Great Smoky Mountains or something because he so loved the mountains. And it would seem to imply some I don't know, some sort of superstitious idea that maybe his spirit could be diffused among the, you know, the trees of the Great Smoky Mountain National Forest. And that obviously is not how the thing works, and that would be a superstitious reason.
Sure, sure.
I think a lot of times others are motivated by really pragmatic concern if it's just more affordable. It's a more affordable option. It can be quite expensive to bury somebody and buy a funeral plot and buy a headstone and buy a coffin and all this kind of thing. So that could be a lot of reasons that people would want to cremate. But again, this is a... some sociologist someplace has likely studied the question of the evolution of the acceptance of cremation in American culture, and that would be an empirical question you could investigate.
Very good. And does the church still prefer a regular burial?
Yes, they do. The church prefers burial to cremation because it seems more consonant with the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead and the dignity of the body, but recognizes that economic and other exigencies can make cremation sometimes the best option.
Marla, thanks so much for both of your questions. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Calls are coming in right now. We'd love to add yours to the list at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's one from Sam. I saw an article, he says, that said Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI could not donate his organs because he was Pope. Is this true? And if so, why?
There is a whole protocol around papal burial.
Okay.
Do you know how often in life I have needed to know the protocol around papal burial?
Let me think about that.
You know,
no.
When I was learning what my duties and obligations were as a Catholic and perusing relevant church documents, I thought, you know, one of these days I might be called upon to inter the Pope. I better get really beefed up on this area of the church law. No, wrong. I'm not beefed up on that area of church law. But I can tell you that Pope's remains, don't become Pope if you're not ready to be put under glass.
Yeah.
Basically. You know, I mean, the church is just very, very conscientious about what it does with the bodies of popes because you're not going to be canonized if you're not saintly, but lots of saintly people don't get canonized. Most people who are saints are not canonized.
Okay.
If you're going to get canonized, it means that you have some prominence and that you know, there's some probability that there's going to be a public cult to your veneration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Popes are pretty good candidates. If they attain sanctity, that canonization could very well be in the works for them. And, you know, when it comes to canonized saints, Catholics are real possessive about the bodies of our canonized saints. We like to hang on to those suckers. And, you know, you might end up with a piece of the liver of some pope one day down the line, you know, in a tiny little reliquary.
Sure.
So in the Middle Ages, this is a true story, right? We're more civilized now, but, you know, the late Middle Ages had a high respect for ascetics, for hermits, you know, live out in the edge of town and grow their hair long and, you know, live on a diet of stale bread and wild rabbits or something.
Oh, my.
And they'd, you know, pray, and people would ask them to pray and so forth. And when the hermits started looking a little bit green around the gills, maybe, you know, pushing up there in years, and the villagers thought, you know, he might kick off at any moment, they would mount guard around the hermit. This is true. This really happened. They would mount guard, right? Because if the guy expired in the night, what would happen is sometimes some guy from the next village down the road would sneak in, they'd run off with the body of the dead hermit, then they'd have their own relics.
Wow.
And so the local village is like, dude, hands off, this our dead guy. We're not giving you can't get our dead guy, you know.
Go get some other dead guy.
Go get your other dead guy. This is our dead guy. We're keeping him, right?
Wow.
When St. Thomas Aquinas died.
Yeah, yeah.
He died in a Benedictine monastery. And the Benedictines were like, oh, goody, 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 goody. We got us another one, you know. Because Thomas had been educated by the Benedictines.
Yeah.
And the Dominicans had to go to the Pope, and they were like, Pope, the Benedictines are loaded with dead guys. Like, this is one of our first ones. We got to hang on to this. So they gave him back to the Dominicans.
Wow. You never know what's going to pop up on this program. It is called Communion here on EWTN. In a moment, John in Houston. Lines are open for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. Call now. Glad you're with us for this edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-3986. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Or if you're watching on TV, shoot us an email, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Hey, congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating an incredible 22 years with us. Wow. Catholic Radio of South Carolina. They now have 10 stations serving many cities across the state. I believe they're covering just about all of South Carolina. Congratulations to Michael Brennan and Gary Towery and their great team there in South Carolina from your friends here at EWTN. All right, let's go now to John, a first-time caller in Houston, listening on the great Guadalupe Radio Network, AM 1430. Hey, John, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I had two questions. The first one is, why are Catholic Bibles bigger? And the second question is a little different. Is it okay to decide to date only Catholic women and to go out with several women and then down the road try to become exclusively dating one person before looking to get married? That's the two questions I have. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thanks so much. I really appreciate the question. So Catholic Bibles are larger than Protestant Bibles because they contain more books. The Catholic Bible has 7 books that the Protestant Bible does not contain. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but basically in the ancient world, there were multiple versions of the Old Testament floating around. There was a Hebrew version that lacked some books that were added in a Greek version. There was a Greek version of the Old Testament produced by diaspora Jews, that is to say, Jews that lived outside of Judea and the Holy Land, and Egypt in particular. And it was the latter, it was the Greek version of the Old Testament that was the Bible of the early Christians. And it is the Bible that the New Testament quotes much more often than not. And about 95% of the time when the New Testament quotes the Old Testament, it's quoting that Greek version of the Old Testament that contains those books. And so those books entered into Catholic liturgy and Catholic theological reflection at a very early stage and were commented upon and read and prayed as sacred scripture from the beginning. You know, there were books in the Old and New Testament that were controversial, some in the New Testament too, that eventually made it into the canon. So the fact that some of these books may at one time have been controversial doesn't count against their canonicity, but the fact of the matter is they were maintained by ecclesiastical use down through the centuries. In the 16th century, Protestants began to diminish those books. They didn't explicitly take them out of the canon, but they began to diminish them, principally, I think, because the content of those 7 books is more amenable to a Catholic than to a Protestant interpretation. Protestants rejected things like the intercession of saints and angels and prayers for the dead, all of which can be found in these deuterocanonical texts. And so, you know, the Protestant church was kind of uncomfortable with them and, you know, would say disparaging things about them. Eventually, Protestant printers realized they could save on printing costs if they just didn't print them. And so early Protestant Bibles wouldn't contain them, but the people were cautioned to treat them as of secondary value. And eventually, it wasn't a sort of a systematic decision. It was a very pragmatic one. It's just, hey, we can save some money if we leave these suckers out.
Wow.
So they just started printing them without the 7 books, and that became the standard practice. So that's why the difference. Dating practices, you know. So the Catholic Church says that marriage is a vocation and that the goal of marriage is to sanctify yourself and your spouse in order to bring children into the world, to raise them up in the fear and love of God and their neighbor as good Catholic people. And so one should find a spouse with whom one can share that objective, right? That someone with whom you can see marriage as a sacred institution, in fact, a sacrament of the Catholic Church, the point of which is to create this new society called the family, with the help of God's grace, to sanctify yourself and your spouse and your children, right, for the love of God and ultimately for the destiny of heaven. It's not easy to find people who are willing to sign on to that program, because the world in which we live has a very different conception of marriage, which I would say the overwhelming conception of marriage is that it's a relationship that's grounded in romantic attraction that is first and foremost about gratifying, you know, my own need to feel accepted and loved and to have a companion who will be with me forever and help take care of my needs and satisfy my desires. And, you know, probably somebody with whom I have a, you know, sort of share a common set of sexual interests and these sorts of things. And when those kinds of elements break down, then the relationships break down and divorce ensues, right? So it's more about, you know, how do I feel about this and is it making me happy? And, you know, do our sexual proclivities line up the same way? And that's sort of the controlling idea in the modern concept of marriage. And a lot of people are willing to sign up for that, and it's a relationship more or less of convenience. I mean, it may involve commitment and sacrifice, but I mean, it's grounded in like a kind of a different conception of the end of the thing. And children may or may not be desirable in the way that, say, having pets may or may not be desirable, right? Well, you want children? Well, I don't know if I want children. Okay, children off the list. You know, no, that's not like an option in Catholic land, right? It's an institution that's for the sake of replenishing society, and. While I may derive great personal satisfaction from marriage, it's not about me. It's about the community of the family that I create. And so if down the road, my wife and I find that our interests diverge and, you know, our affections diverge and the romance drops out and maybe one of them wakes up one day and says, you know, I've decided that I've changed my sexuality even, right? Well, does that mean you're not married? No. Does that mean you don't have kids together? No. Is there a time when I should put all those things behind me and say, does it really matter? My personal happiness isn't the goal. It's the welfare of my family and my mutual sanctification that's the goal. And so, yeah, maybe I could sacrifice my own sexual interests or my romantic passions or my need to be heard or felt or understood or whatever it is in the interest of serving something bigger than myself. They're very different conceptions of the nature of the institution.
Yes.
And so it's very important to find somebody who can sign on to that and somebody with whom you're psychologically compatible. You know, you're not going to get there by throwing darts, you know, and I suppose there's a lot of different selection methodology you could have in some cultures in the world today that are Catholic. People rely heavily on the guidance of their parents or their families or their connections, right, for those kinds of relationships. In the West, we don't really do that. You know, I mean, it's kind of hard. I have a hard time imagining most Catholic guys saying, "Mom, would you pick out a wife for me? Go, let's get into negotiations with the neighbor down the street." That's not how we do it here, you know?
No.
And so I think you kind of have to be open to getting to know a lot of people and ask a lot of questions and see if you can build that kind of life together. And then eventually, of course, you're going to have to reach a stage of exclusivity that's ordered toward marriage. Like, okay, we're really committed to the idea that maybe this is it. Maybe we're the couple that's for each other. Let's discern this. Let's get some formation. Let me go talk to the priest, get some marriage instruction. And we're not committed yet, but we're aiming that way. At that point of the game, you're not going out with Mary on Friday and asking Susie to the dance on Tuesday.
Right,
you know, you're not at that. So yeah, I think that sort of the idea of a, you know, like a conical shape of like, you know, narrowing focus down towards one person is the right way to think about it.
John, thanks so much for your call today from Houston. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still have a couple lines open at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. A few moments ago, we were talking about the great Catholic radio in South Carolina and representing that wonderful state, Alan in Charleston. And Alan, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes. Hi, Dr. David Andrews. Alan, along with the same question about the body burial and the cremation and the church's view on that, my conflict is that, and I'm in agreement that I'd prefer to be buried with my body, but cremation may become an issue or a choice, whether it's those are done by, you know, when people get burned up in a fire or their body parts are all over the place and they just can't really figure it all out. But the church, what the conflict, the hypocritical part that bothers me is yet we take the saints' body parts, first relics, and we distribute them all over the place, all over the world. And we are, as Catholics, all supposed to strive to be saints, whether we're a big saint or a small saint, however you want to say it. So that's a conflict.
No, I don't think it's a conflict at all, but I do appreciate the question, and I think I understand what you're saying, but I don't think there's any conflict at all, because what does the disposition of saints' bodies and burial, what do they have in common? And they have something profoundly in common, and that is the idea of respect for the body. Now, the forms of respect differ, because in the case of the bodies of saints, the kind of respect that we are paying is the respect of veneration. We are venerating the bodies of the saints. St. Gregory of Nyssa said that we venerate Christ in his members. When it comes to the burial of those who are not canonized saints, we are respecting them by placing them in an honored place of rest and praying for the repose of their souls. So veneration is not appropriate because they're not canonized saints, but repose and intercession is appropriate. So different forms of respect, depending on the respective status of the person who died, right? Those are very different from, say, exposure, or, you know, tossing them in a ditch, or cremating them and then scattering their ashes on the Ganges, or whatever it might be. There are a lot of other forms of burial or disposal of the dead that do not imply respect for the body and belief in the resurrection, not the least to say belief that our bodies are members of Christ.
Appreciate your call, Alan. Thanks so much for it. Call to communion here on EWTN. Glad that you're with us, and we'd like to remind you about a wonderful podcast now available at EWTN's Podcast Central, and I can really relate to the title of it. It's called Just a Guy in the Pew. We're talking Catholic man to Catholic man on this great podcast. No fancy jargon, just real honest conversations from the heart as John and Victor discuss their struggles, challenges, and unimaginable joy of following Christ. It's a wonderful podcast. And it's called, again, Just a Guy in the Pew. You can hear it and other faith-filled podcasts at EWTN's Podcast Central. To get there, visit EWTN.com/radio. Look for the words Podcast Central. They're up in the upper right corner of the screen. Once you click on Podcast Central, you're going to see about 100 great podcasts, programs like this one that we produce here in-house, and also some wonderful podcasts like this one that we're talking about, Just a Guy in the Pew. It's fantastic. Do visit EWTN's Podcast Central as soon as you can. Here is an email now from Terry. Terry says, how can I explain Jeremiah 17:5 to my confirmation student?
All right, pardon me for not having Jeremiah 17:5 memorized.
Keeping you honest here.
Yeah. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who draws strength from mere flesh, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. I have to go back and look at the total context, which I don't have in front of me right now.
Yeah.
But a constant theme in the prophets is that Israel, or Judah as the case may be, should not place its confidence in, say, the size of its army or the number of chariots that it has or the number of horses that it has, this kind of thing, because that's not going to override divine providence. And it's much more important to place their trust in God, that make obedience to the covenant and to God's will paramount. And then ultimately God will prevail. Now, you know, the challenge that Israel had is that many of them thought they were doing that, and yet here comes Babylon.
Yeah.
Right. And they still suffer terribly. And so the later parts of the Old Testament confront this challenge of, wait, we thought we were doing that covenant thing, and here we got the stuffing kicked out of us by the Assyrians and now by the Babylonians. What does this all mean, right? And so you have a lot of Psalms, you have whole books of the Bible that confront this problem. Job, the person of Job, seems to be like a singular literary character that encapsulates what Israel collectively had suffered. Like, we thought we were doing okay, and now we are suffering, and we have no explanation for it, right? Yeah. What is the meaning of this? And the second half of Isaiah introduces a concept in a literary figure called the suffering servant, which the prophet tells us explicitly is Israel. He says, Israel, my servant. And there's a whole bunch of Psalms about how the servant suffers at the hands of unjust men. But even though he suffers to the point of death, God will prolong his days and raise him back up again. And within the context, it seems to mean that it introduced this idea of redemptive suffering, that yes, Babylon came, devastated Judea, took people into exile, But God will bring something out of the ashes of that, from that crucible of suffering that'll be even better, and Israel will be the bearer of that destiny, of that identity. Now, what happens in the New Testament is the New Testament writers say, yeah, what you wrote corporately about Israel in the person of a literary figure, what if that literary figure actually took on flesh and became a singular person? And Israel was long familiar with the idea that a single individual could stand in for the entire nation. You remember David standing up against Goliath on behalf of all of Israel, right?
Yeah.
Or more negatively, when the northern kingdom rejects the Davidic monarch, Rehoboam, they don't say, we're getting rid of Rehoboam. They say, what part have we in David? Right, we're rejecting the whole dynasty and the whole kingdom, right, represented in the singular person of the king.
Yeah.
So the New Testament writers say, well, what if this corporate person that is the servant of God in the Old Testament actually takes on flesh and becomes a singular human being, and so that that destiny of redemptive suffering, you know, death, degradation, alienation, exile, rejection, and then redemption becomes the fate of a singular person in whom we can be found in the same way that Israel was found in David. What if we could be found in that guy so that his victory over alienation and death and hell in the grave becomes ours? And then you have what we call Christology, right? This is the church's doctrine of Christ.
And there it is. Appreciate that, Terry. Thanks so much for your email. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Jack is driving through Missouri, listening on the Great Covenant Radio. Hello, Jack. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. So I have a question. It has to do with the priesthood, and only the Catholic priests are, well, I guess also Orthodox, but can confect the Eucharist. And so I'm wondering how the priesthood is connected with the Old Testament Levitical priesthood, and how they're like in the Old Testament they could only be the priests could only be Levite or something to that effect.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out. Sure, absolutely. So in the Old Testament, Israel has a problem, and the problem is also a blessing. It is the problem slash blessing of God's presence with them. And it's a great blessing, but it comes at a great cost. Because if you've read the Old Testament, you know, if Israel approaches the presence of God with the wrong disposition, they get zapped. And so a great deal of Old Testament law, particularly Levitical law around the priesthood and the sacrifices, has to do with managing. God's presence in the Old Testament is a bit like a nuclear power plant. Like, it's powerful. I mean, it's really there to help you. But if you don't take care of those fusion rods, man, they're going to burn you up, right? and so the whole sacrificial ritual and the sort of the regime of the holy, the clean, and the unclean, right? Managing that is a major preoccupation, because you get that wrong, and man, you're going to have a nuclear meltdown on your hands, right? And the two things that never come into contact. You don't ever bring the unclean together with the holy. You do that, you know, it's lights out, okay? And the priesthood mediates that. In the New Testament, something fascinating happens. St. Paul in particular borrows that whole architecture, but he abstracts it from the temple in Jerusalem. And he places it instead in the heart of the Christian community, which becomes the new temple. Right, not built out of stones. And St. Peter talks about this too, right? You're living, you know, temple not made with stones from human hands, but made out of your human lives. And the priesthood is something that's, first of all, belongs to the entire community by way of baptism, that every Christian becomes a priest in virtue of their baptism. And the whole holiness, cleanliness, uncleanliness thing gets translated from a cultic temple context into the context of the ethical life and the interior life. Thus, St. Paul will say, purify yourselves of everything that contaminates flesh or spirit out of reverence for God. You know, be transformed by the renewing of your minds, these kinds of things. And the sacrificial aspect of that cult is the offering of ourselves along with the ritual offering of Christ's body and blood given to us in the Holy Eucharist. And this is the subject matter of 1 Corinthians 10 and 11.
Okay.
And Paul makes it very clear that, you know, as Israel could approach the Old Testament sacrifices in a state of ritual impurity, Christians can approach it in a state of ritual impurity as well, but it's, excuse me, of moral impurity if they are not, for example, loving their neighbors. And so Paul admonishes the Corinthians, you guys are not actually offering the proper sacrifice to God here because you're in enmity with one another, and that's not the right disposition. But it is the apostles and those sent by them that officiate over this whole apparatus. And so Paul, for example, will refer to himself as a priest in Romans chapter 15, saying that it is his priestly duty to configure the Gentiles as a pure offering to God, right? And this is the church's understanding. So if you read even modern Catholic theology, like Sacrosanctum Concilium, which is the Second Vatican Council's doctrine on the liturgy, we read that the people have to understand that they offer the Immaculate Victim Christ, not only through the hands of the ministerial priest who effects the offering, but also along with him, they themselves offer it as they offer themselves. St. Paul says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is your spiritual act of worship. St. Pius XII, Pope Pius XII, writes an encyclical on the liturgy called Mediator Dei, where he says the church has these two offerings. We have the ritual offering of the Eucharist, and we have the interior offering of the self. And of the two, the most important is actually the interior offering of the self. Because if you have the ritual offering of the Eucharist, but you don't bring your penitence, your contrition, your love, your piety to that offering, then you come, as St. Paul says, with the wrong disposition, and you're just eating and drinking your own condemnation.
Yeah.
Right? But it's the ministerial priesthood that officiates the whole process, although the entire church participates in the priestly dignity of offering themselves along with the body and blood of Christ.
Jack, great question. Thanks so much for checking in from Missouri. Called to Communion here on EWTN. In our 10 years on the air, David, I have never heard these two questions, and this is in an email from Ronnie.
What shoe size do you wear?
Well, there's that.
Okay,
here we go. Can I eat blessed salt? And is blessed salt used in witchcraft?
Yeah. Can you eat blessed salt? Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, yeah, I mean, you can, to be sure.
Okay.
Is it used in witchcraft? You know, gosh, Tom, I left my book on witchcraft at home.
What a shame.
Again, this is one of those areas of study. I have fortunately never bothered my head with studying the ritual paraphernalia of modern witchcraft. And I think I could pretty comfortably go to my grave without ever studying that body of material, and I'll be just fine. So I know very little about what modern witches do or don't do and what use they may or may not make of Catholic sacramentals. And I'm okay with my ignorance there.
Attaboy. Ronnie, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Joe watching us on YouTube today. Joe says, my question is, why would Jesus have Thomas examine the wounds so closely? Speaking here of the apostle, wouldn't seeing them be enough? That is from the gospel reading. Thanks, Joe.
Well, you know, it was Thomas that put him up to it.
Well, that's true.
Because he said, I won't believe until I put my hands in his side and touch his wounds. So Jesus is like, okay, buddy, you asked for it. You got it. Toyota.
Put up or shut up.
Put up or shut up.
There it is.
You remember that ad? You asked for it. You
sure,
got it, Toyota.
Sure.
Yeah.
Joe, thanks so much for watching us on YouTube today. A quick question here from Rachel. Are pontifical commissions infallible and dogmatic?
No and no. Although maybe in a small d sense, sometimes yes, depending on the personalities involved. But
okay.
No and no. So you know, a commission is just what it sounds like. It's a body of people that may be appointed to study a particular issue.
Okay.
And you know, popes have consultative bodies that they can make use of, and just like any consultative body, they can make use of them or not. I mean, the consultative body may go out and do a bunch of research and come back and go, this is what we found. The pope can say, well, you know, I don't like that very much, so we're going to do something else.
All right. And Rachel, thanks for your email. We'll close with this from Alex. What is a labyrinth walk, and why are other non-Catholic churches doing these walks?
I don't know. I don't have a clue what a labyrinth walk is. You know, this is, generally speaking, a show about the Catholic faith, so I'm If it's a non-Catholic tradition that I've studied, then I know something about it. But yeah. I've never encountered the labyrinth walk unless we're talking about a scene from the David Bowie movie.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Now we're really getting into pop culture.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so Alex, that's where we got to leave it. I do appreciate hearing from you. And by the way, if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here is that address again, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Fast-moving program today, Dr. David Anders. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, we do it Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. You can check out our podcast anytime you wish by going to EWTN's Podcast Central. Find it at EWTN.com/radio. Then look for those words, Podcast Central. Click on that and you are good to go. We even put them in alphabetical order to make it easier for you to find any show that you're looking for. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us today. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a wonderful day and God bless.